This is Global Voices Radio.
Yes, Paul Nelson.
In a modern society like ours, we can get so satisfied with our advanced technology and think we have all the answers. However, the rates of stress and stress-related illness may suggest we don't. The people at the Center for Traditional Medicine are at the cutting edge of an integration of modern science and the wellness wisdom of traditional cultures. The center's director is Dr. Leslie Korn, who has an impeccable background in both types of healing modalities, with a special affinity for the role of therapeutic touch.
As you touch the body therapeutically, the body tells a story. The body tells the story of the car accident that's never resolved. It tells the story of a physical assault or a sexual assault, which is so epidemic in our society.
Leslie Korn holds a master's in public health from Harvard, a PhD in behavioral medicine and medical humanities, and many other titles. Her work has convinced her that utilizing the traditional diet of one's culture, as determined by blood type, can lead to a greater wellness.
The blood typing diet is very valid, and it's also part of a larger spectrum that we call metabolic typing, in which you eat according to your cultural heritage.
If you are interested in the leading edge of health and wellness, there may not be many people around the world more qualified to talk than Dr. Leslie Korn of the Center for Traditional Medicine. Browsing websites of organizations focused on medicine, there are few that would make the link between culture and illness. But that's what you'll see on the front page of the website for the Center for Traditional Medicine. A project of the Center for World Indigenous Studies, the Center for Traditional Medicine conducts research, education, and clinical treatment that integrates traditional systems of indigenous healing with a complementary and integrative medicine. Dr. Leslie Korn holds a PhD in behavioral medicine and medical humanities, a master's in cross-cultural health psychology, and she's earned a master's in public health from Harvard University. She was a clinical fellow in psychology and religion and clinical instructor in psychology at Harvard Medical School, is a licensed psychotherapist, a registered polarity therapy practitioner, and is board certified in therapeutic massage and bodywork. My God, that's a mouthful. You've been busy, haven't you?
I certainly have.
Yes. You know, the people who I get on this program tell fascinating stories about how they ended up following their idiosyncratic paths, their unconventional paths. When did you realize that what we might call conventional or allopathic medicine was something that you felt was lacking?
I had the opportunity in my late teens to learn meditation. And that introduced me really to consciousness practices. And soon after, I went to the university but was dissatisfied there and dropped out and went on a voyage to Mexico. And it was when I arrived in Mexico and had numerous health problems there that I began to make the link between the mind and the body and learning about how to heal naturally in the jungle where there was no doctor.
Could you elaborate on that, some of the illnesses?
Oh, well, I was living in the tropical rainforest of the west coast of Mexico, and I encountered everything, scorpion bites, typhoid, dengue, hepatitis, dysentery of all varieties, intestinal parasites, you name it.
Now this is you?
Yes, me personally.
It sounds like this is the practice. You're treating people like this, but no, this is your body we're talking
this
about.
This is my body. It was the laboratory for learning, and that was my opportunity. And I mind you, though, this was all over the course of 10 years. This was not all in one fell swoop.
It was not the two-week vacation from hell.
No, and actually, I would say it was quite luxurious and a tremendous experience. So the illnesses were just a vehicle to learn.
Yeah, and that notion that illnesses are a vehicle to learn, one would say permeates your work and the work of the center, does it not?
That's right. We look at the role of illness as an opportunity for growth and change. And while that may sound simplistic or that it might deny the actual material basis for illness, I tend to work with people who are chronically ill for whom allopathic medicine hasn't provided an answer. And really early on in my work, I began to make connections between finding meaning in illness, but also how we make meaning out of our symptoms in the way that that's rooted in our cultural heritage. And so the meaning that I might find may be different from the meaning you might find, and whole cultures really make meaning out of illness in very different ways.
I certainly want to follow up that notion of culture and illness and the link. First of all, I think it might be good to say that allopathic medicine is medicine that focuses on treating symptoms. Is that what we're saying, basically?
Correct, right. Yeah.
Tell us about how the center got started.
Well, I lived, as I said, I arrived in Mexico in 1973, and I began by teaching school there. I had a little one-room schoolhouse for a small number of children, and was working there, and, as I say, became ill, and it really spurred my own interest. And I came out of a feminist background in Boston in the early 70s and was very much committed to community health, women's reproductive health, and slowly began inviting women over to my house, women in the village. I learned from them. They learned from me. We used the text, Our Bodies, Ourselves, and slowly the center evolved as a meeting place to cook together, to study our mutual traditions, to share knowledge, to support the traditions within the village, but also to bring in what I understood as women's health rights and reproductive health knowledge. And at the time, women didn't have access to birth control, so that's where we began. And then it just grew from there. One of the things that we did to support ourselves was invite health professionals over the years down to live and study and experience life in the village and learn a whole different way of being, a whole different type of medicine as a way to support our work.
You know, the Grameen Bank gives microloans to people around the world, largely to women. There seems to me a link between educating the women in a culture and seeing tremendous gains in certainly the education and in the prosperity of a culture. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. Over the years, we've focused on working with women, though we didn't. It wasn't just women. It was certainly women, children, and men. And more recently, we just finished a 3-year research project called the Women's Traditional Medicine Project on Community Trauma, because we began observing that the effects of development and imposed change, bringing in refined foods and all the kinds of things that were changing the lifestyle of women and their health and the health of all the families, really was leading to community-wide trauma. And so we worked with women around sustaining their traditions and their knowledge as a way to mitigate against the effects of community trauma.
Let me follow that thread. I was reading last night. You know, you do research for this program, and it gets pretty dense, as you can well imagine. And so that, you know, the papers that I printed off your website go down. I pick up a book of poetry, and what do I find? I find links. I find a poem by a former Portland poet, Carl Haney, entitled Above and Beyond, that opens like this. I'm with the birds. On a ridge in the Mojave Desert, hillocks shimmer and rise in the distance, floating like islands in the sea of pinon, choya, and Joshua trees. Old Chappie next to me strokes his camcorder and says in that well-fed, self-satisfied way, lot of undeveloped real estate out there. Yes, I say, delivering hate mail to his soul, and we'll leave it that way today. See, the poet sees the evils of development, but you go on that and suggest in a paper that colonialism has mutated into the current plague of development and that the history of development is a history of trauma.
That's correct.
That's heavy.
Well, my work, I began by touching bodies. That was how my healing work began. You note all of my academic training, but I would insist that I'm a healer first, and the academic world backs up a lot of that knowledge, but it also opens doors to bring this knowledge into areas where it's currently not known. And so my own work came out of the influence of my Romanian grandmother's heritage. I began touching the body. And as you touch the body therapeutically, the body tells a story. The body tells the story of the car accident that's never resolved. It tells the story of a physical assault or a sexual assault, which is so epidemic in our society. And so as I began working with the women in the village, and the men as well, who were traumatized from diving accidents, for example, they began telling the stories of their traumatic experiences. And from there, what happened was it became obvious that it wasn't just an individual trauma that was occurring, though that certainly is quite epidemic, but that whole communities were being traumatized by other communities or corporations or governments that were saying, this is how you need to live, and this is the way you should live, whether it's using these medicines or using these foods. And it was supplanting people's choices about how to live. And ultimately, that's what trauma is. It's being overwhelmed by someone else's or some other body's telling you what to do and how you should do it.
We're talking with Dr. Leslie Korn. She's the director of the Center for Traditional Medicine, which has branches in Mexico and Olympia, Washington. I'm Paul Nelson. That's good. That was my next question, was how do you define trauma? And so we're not setting it up as necessarily the evil colonialist versus the innocent indigenous peoples, but there was trauma that was inflicted between tribes, for example. So this is not an us versus them kind of situation, but a recognition of how trauma manifests and the ramifications of that trauma. Maybe you can talk about that chain. You can talk about the chain of ailments that are symptomatic of stress in one's life, starting with a fight or flight response that never shuts down.
Okay. Well, certainly when we're exposed to overwhelming experiences, our body goes into a state of reaction, and it's a positive reaction. It's the same if we're driving in a car and someone slams on the brakes in front of us, our heart pounds, our stomach gets a little queasy, but we pump adrenaline into the system because it gives us a bright thought, it gives us a quick reflex, and we can get out of the way. And that's a natural animal-based response that we have to get out of the way of danger. Now, what happens is if we have overwhelming experiences like that repeatedly, our body is constantly pumping out that adrenaline. And over time, we become exhausted. We become both overwhelmed and what's called hypervigilant, meaning always looking over our shoulder, always thinking that something is going to get us. And we become on edge. Our brain cells start to decrease because of the effects of cortisol on the brain. We become edgy, irritable, uptight, and it begins to reflect in our nervous system. We begin to get stomach ailments. The liver doesn't function as well. You don't digest food as well, and it all has a cycling effect that over time, if it becomes chronic, causes heart disease and causes chronic digestive problems.
Yeah, armoring of the body, which certainly when you get into massage, you understand how that armoring manifests.
Yes.
And we quite often in this society, what our responses to this is a little boost here and there. So a coffee habit, maybe instead of that one cup of coffee in the morning, it becomes three or four cups of coffee, maybe a sugary treat, a candy bar in the afternoon. And this has the effect of giving us that short-term boost, but in the long-term, really decimating our adrenal glands and our health.
That's correct, because if we get to that exhaustion stage, we begin to do what is called self-medicate. And traditionally, we think of substance use or substance abuse in a very narrow form, but really we can think about everything that we take into our bodies or expose ourselves to as substances that are either beneficial or negative. And when we use coffee as a drug to stay awake for a particular reason once in a while, then it's used in its appropriate way. If we take three or four cups a day so that we need more and more all the time, then clearly it does affect our adrenal glands and really does not do anything for our health, and in turn depletes it.
Yeah, I guess the current term in vogue would be the Jones, coffee Jones, or having a monkey on your back, that kind of notion. Let's go back to the notion of how culture shapes illness. That is something that I think that one of the things that Dr. Reeser talked about, your colleague at the Center for World Indigenous Studies, but that's fascinating. I mean, how do you begin to get that across to the average person who might be skeptical of this approach?
Well, there are many ways we can think about it. I have a particular interest, as I say, in traumatic stress. But, you know, the medical system hasn't really recognized the link between trauma and health until the last 30 years. Really, all of our Vietnam veterans coming back from the war really put it on the front burner. We have a tendency as a society to negate the effects of trauma coming out of war. We see it currently with the Iraq War and the suffering that we're seeing going on with many of the veterans.
The very high suicide rates.
High suicide rates. So as a society, we tend to deny the reality of these traumas. And if you go back in time and study the history of trauma, you will see that in the early 1900s, it was called shell shock, coming out of World War I. And men particularly were the main veterans in World War I, and they were considered sissies or homosexuals because they reacted so poorly to war. They reacted as anyone would react naturally, which was become teary-eyed, they would become incontinent, they would become depressed. Whatever those symptoms are of trauma, we've seen over the centuries. And so in the 19th century, it was not considered manly to be affected by war. If you go back 200 years earlier, you see, or 100 years earlier, you see in Victorian times as well, where men were considered, quote, hysterical, which was a term applied only to women at the time. So once again, you see not only the cultural overlay that puts value judgments on human response to experience, but also the gender overlay. Now, if you go back to the early Greek times where there was war, you see that people recognize the symptoms of trauma, and the term hysteria, which we all understand what those connotations are of being out of control and being, quote, hysterical, comes out of the term hyster, meaning womb. And it was associated with women's experience of the floating womb, of a womb that has lost its location. And so if we look over the last 1,000 years, we can see how the same human experience of being overwhelmed by horrifying experiences have different names and different value judgments attached to them. And I suspect in the next 100 years, our knowledge and understanding of these experiences will grow so that what we consider today will perhaps be considered as barbaric as 1,000 years ago.
Do you believe that is a function of the evolution of humans?
Certainly it is. But I also think that in any time period, we have humans who have what I would call an evolved awareness of the nature of the whole depth and breadth of human capacity. And at the same time, there's a repression of that knowledge. And so we have today, I think, practices that help us become more aware of the integrative notion of who we are physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually. And at the same time, we have a denial of those aspects. And we can look 1,000 years ago to the wisdom, or 2,000 or 5,000 years ago to the onset of Chinese medicine and Ayurvedic Indian medicine, or the traditions of the native cultures of this hemisphere. And there are certainly there's evidence, there's writing that portrays an integrated notion of human capacity at the optimal range.
Let's talk about some of the healing methods that you practice that aid in the reversal of these kinds of trauma.
I work with an integrative approach, certainly using nutrition and botanical plants. My particular interest is in the role of touch and the way that you can touch therapeutically through a system called polarity therapy, though it's not limited to polarity. They're all types of touch, cranial sacral methods, different types of massage, ways of touching the body so that you give the body a voice to tell its story. In our Cartesian model of medicine, of allopathy, the body is a little less important than the mind. And so we give the body equal value and equal importance to what the mind and the words have to say. And we provide a safe space for the whole being to relax, to become aware of the story their body has to tell, and to allow those words to come through the symptoms, and to explore pain and discomfort in a way in which one is not fearful, but in which one can tell the story of their lives.
I'd like to get a sense of how that manifests through a specific example. So you start dealing with a symptom, and then perhaps a memory is then rekindled in the person. And you say, did you ever fall on your head? Well, you know, one time I fell out of the hammock there in Mexico, and maybe that has something to do with it. And we kind of forget about this or don't make the link, but these are some of the links that you make. Could you describe
Yes.
that?
Yes. Generally, what happens when we become ill or we hurt ourselves or have pain is that we take substances like painkillers to suppress that pain and say, go away. But we don't necessarily allow the body and acknowledge that the body has the capacity to heal naturally and to process the emotional aspect of that experience as well as the physical. So I'll give you an example. I was working with a woman in Mexico. She was 62 years old, and she came in with a very painful spastic shoulder muscle. And as I began touching her and as she began relaxing, she began to have a memory that she had not had for 50 years. And she told the story, as I worked in this muscle, of having been raised in a convent, and the nuns put a broom behind her shoulders and pulled her arms back so that she would sit up straight. And she had to do this every day. She was a woman from Brazil who had migrated to Mexico. And she had not remembered this, but the touching of the spastic muscle, which clearly was occurring in present time, had a history within that muscle that had been stored there. By touching it, by remembering the memory, by processing, by her crying, by having someone listen to her story without judgment, allowed her to release the spasm and to integrate an old painful trauma.
Yeah, and it's an amazing story. It's happened to me on many occasions, and of course I'm into natural medicine and have experienced all kinds of different modalities. And what do you say to the skeptic who wants to know the science behind it? The science behind this is beginning to emerge, isn't it? And it comes out of the 20th century science, which is what, 100 years old now? I mean, some of the quantum physics revelations?
Yes. Well, I take two approaches. One is I give a little bit of the science. Certainly Candace Pert has done some very good research at the National Institutes of Health looking at how memory and emotions are communicated through neuropeptides in the body. There's some interesting research that suggests that the cortisol and the stress hormones lay down memory in the body so that the moment of impact, let's say in a car accident, when you dissociate, when you leave your body, when you experience that memory loss of that moment of impact, that what's happening is your body is actually laying down that moment in your tissue. Your mind may not remember it, but your body does. But more importantly, what I say to the skeptics are, experience it. Because the skeptic is working through the mind, is working through the cerebral process, saying, prove it to me. But so much of our proof in life is through experience. If you say to me, prove to me what love is about, I would say, I can't really explain to you love. You have to experience it, and then you know it from within. And I said the same things in all of my lectures back at Harvard Medical School. It was, come on, let's have this experience, and you go through the process. And actually, most of my patients were psychiatrists and psychologists who, research shows, tend to be the most phobic about the body and the most phobic about touch.
It's interesting how you use the example of love, because that might be at the core of what the deficiency is there.
I agree. I think ultimately we can give all of this very fancy names and explanations, but we're really talking about connecting in an authentic way with another human being or with communities and sharing that heart energy, that love.
Dr. Leslie Korn runs the Center for Traditional Medicine, which has branches in Olympia and Mexico, and more information on their website, centerfortraditionalmedicine.org.